out of Philly, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Lucerne. In a recent episode, I said that one of God's reasons for creating a universe is to enter into friendship with humans. I discussed some of the general features of a friendly universe, but there's one feature that I did not discuss: the incarnation. Given that Easter is right around the corner, I want to offer some of my own reflections on why I think God became incarnate. If you'd like to support the show, you can donate money to my Patreon account or my Ko-fi account. Any donation amount helps me out in so many ways. I really appreciate all of the support that people have already offered. If you've got questions or topics you'd like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here I am talking about the God-man. Enjoy. With Easter right around the corner, Christians around the world are about to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. There is going to be a lot of reflection on Jesus' death and resurrection and the significance that that has for our salvation. This raises some important questions. Here's one question. Why would God choose to become incarnate? Most Christians, they're going to answer that God became incarnate in order to offer salvation or atonement to humanity. And I agree that that's a good reason for why God would become incarnate. However, there are other reasons for God to become incarnate, and those other reasons, they're usually overlooked. In fact, there's a whole line of thought within the Christian tradition that says God would have become incarnate even if humans never needed atonement. This is sometimes called the incarnation anyway view, because the idea is God would have become incarnate no matter what happens in human history. This view has an interesting pedigree. Various theologians and philosophers have affirmed it throughout history, John Duns Scotus being the most famous example. But there are other people, like Nicholas Mailbranch. Mailbranch actually argues that the incarnation is a prerequisite for God to create anything at all. For Mailbranch, the only possible universes worth creating are ones where God becomes incarnate. In our own day, Alvin Plantinga offers a similar kind of argument in his work on the problem of evil. And then others, like Richard Swinburne and Marilyn McCourt Adams, they've argued that an incarnation anyway view is at the very least plausible, if not true. Then there is a theologian named Francis McConnell in the early 1900s. He was the president of DePaul University in Indiana from 1909 to 1912. McConnell argues for an incarnation anyway view as well. So personally, for me, I'm quite a fan of the incarnation anyway view. In this episode, I want to discuss why I think that God would become incarnate. My primary interest is in reasons that are independent of humanity's need for salvation. So Richard Swinburne, he offers three reasons for thinking that God would become incarnate. And one of the main ones is, of course, the salvation of humanity. But there are two other reasons that Swinburne offers. First, through an incarnation, God can provide important information and encouragement to humanity related to morality and the good life. Humans, they need help understanding how to live a morally good life. Through intuition and through reason, we can often discern moral truths. We really can, but we need a great deal of help in embodying those moral truths in our daily lives. We also need encouragement to live the good life. We need to know that all of our struggles towards righteousness and justice, we need to know if that's going to be really worth it in the end. And Swinburne says that Christ's life, death, and resurrection does exactly that. But then, like I said, there's a third reason that Swinburne gives for the incarnation of God. God would become incarnate in order to enter into solidarity with creatures. This is the reason I find most interesting, so that's going to be the main focus of this episode. I think that a major reason for God to become incarnate is to enter into solidarity and friendship with humanity. Now, in order to help you see this, I need to take a step back and I need to ask a different question. So in the last episode, I briefly talked about God's reason to create a universe. I said that one of God's reasons for creating, just in general, is so that God can enter into friendship with humanity. And then I went on to describe the general features of a friendly universe. This is a universe that provides the right conditions for God and creatures to have genuine friendship. But here's a question that I did not ask in the previous episode. What are the personal consequences for God when God decides to create a universe? I believe that there are several different kinds of personal consequences for God when God goes about creating a universe. Examining the personal consequences of creation for God will help you understand why I think God will decide to become incarnate. I'm going to say that God becomes incarnate because it is the best way for God to accomplish his goal of befriending humans. Also, I'm going to say that God becomes incarnate because that is the morally right thing to do if God is going to create a universe like this one. So, all right, how do I get to these conclusions? Here's the idea. When any being makes a decision to perform an action, there are consequences. Actions always come with consequences, even if those consequences are really big or very small. That's just part of the logic of free actions. The logic of free actions is that they have consequences, and this is true of God and creatures. It's not like God just magically avoids the logic of free action because he's divine. No amount of mystery mongering can escape this conclusion. So here's the first consequence for God when God decides to create. God changes. And look, I know that sounds really radical to say that God changes, but when you affirm biblical truths about God, it's often radical. So if you don't believe me that the Bible explicitly teaches that God can change and that God does in fact change, then go check out my previous episode on immutability. There are several ways that God changes when he decides to create. One is that God's knowledge will change when he makes a decision. So prior to the act of creation, Calvinists, Molinists, and Open Theists, they all agree that God faces an open future. Well, okay, so maybe not. A lot of contemporary Calvinists and Molinists, they like to gloss over this detail, and they like to obfuscate with convoluted notions of eternity and logical moments. I'll eventually do an episode on just that, but here's the dirty little secret that most theologians today do not openly admit. Prior to God's decision to create, God does not know what he himself will do. God only knows that he will create subsequent to his decision to create. That is a change in reality from God being undecided to God being decided. When God decides to create, his knowledge will track his decision. So God's knowledge will correspond to whatever choice he has made, and it's going to track the consequences of that choice. If God decides to create, say, a Calvinist universe or a Molinist universe, then the consequence is that God's going to have exhaustive foreknowledge of what will take place in the universe. If God decides to create an open universe, then the consequence is that God will have an exhaustive knowledge of all the possible and probable timelines that could follow from the divine decision. Whatever God freely decides to do, what God knows will change. Otherwise, God's not omniscient. Now, this kind of knowledge that I've spoken of, it's merely propositional. God's knowledge changes in other respects as well. God's experiential knowledge is going to change. There's something that it's like to create a universe. This is a kind of experiential knowledge that God cannot have without creating a universe. Now, some people, they're going to complain and say that an omniscient God must be able to know such things prior to creation, but I just think that's nonsense. It's one thing to imagine what the experience is like, and it's another to actually experience it. Perhaps God can imagine or simulate what it's like to create a universe. However, experiential knowledge of a simulation, well, that's going to be experiential knowledge of a simulation. It's not the same thing as experiential knowledge of actually creating a universe. A cognitively excellent God can tell the difference between his own imagination and reality. Thus, when God decides to create a universe, God has a new experience and he acquires new experiential knowledge. Now, in the previous episode, I talked about how one feature of a friendly universe is that it's a universe in which creaturely suffering is not only possible, but inevitable. And I discussed various open theists who affirm this, so I'm talking about people like Keith Ward, Richard Swinburne, and John Hick. I think that God's decision to create a universe where creaturely suffering is not only possible, but highly probable, well, that's going to have a significant impact on God's emotional life. So another important consequence of freely creating a universe pertains to God's emotions. God's emotional life will be impacted by the kind of universe that he creates. If God freely decides to create a universe with morally weighty creatures, this has consequences for the kind of emotions God will have. God has decided to create a universe with human persons that he's going to love for all of eternity. And part of what it means for God to love humans is that God values their existence and flourishing. And God values having a union or friendship with humans. Valuing something or caring about something, that creates a disposition to have certain kinds of emotions towards that thing. Because if you care about something, you deem that thing to be worthy of your attention and worthy of you to act on behalf of. An emotion is a felt evaluation of some object or circumstance that is grounded in one's cares and concerns. If God creates a universe with things that are valuable, then God's going to acquire certain stable dispositions or sentiments towards those valuable things. This is because God deems these objects to be worthy of his attention and action. So this concern towards his creatures and his plans for those creatures, that grounds a range of possible emotions that God can have. Now, to be sure, the classical Christian tradition claimed that God is always in a state of pure, undisturbable bliss. They said it's impossible for God to be moved or influenced or even be impacted by creatures in any way whatsoever. In fact, they said that God's emotions are always and only about himself. But this is so far removed from the Christ-like God that one should question is if this is even a Christian conception of God. When one reads the Bible, God is often compared to a parent or a spouse who has strong affections towards his children. I mean, now, sure, like, those are metaphorical statements about God, but those parental and spousal metaphors, they point towards a very clear, literal reality. And the literal reality is that God is emotionally invested in his creatures because he deems them to be worthy of his attention and action. God takes pleasure in his creatures, but God is also perturbed by their sinful actions. And that's exactly what we should expect from a perfectly moral and rational God. Now, as I see it, a perfectly good God will be emotionally impacted by his creation. So Swinburne maintains that if God makes a universe in which creatures suffer, then his perfect goodness would lead him to share in our suffering. So as perfectly good, God will always perform the best possible action, if there is a best possible action, because there's not always a best one. If there is no best action, then God's going to perform just any action that advances his purposes. So in this case, Swinburne thinks that if there is a best action to perform, and he thinks there is one, actually, when it comes to creating this universe, he thinks there is a best action, and that action is for God to choose to suffer with his creatures. In fact, Swinburne thinks that God must become incarnate and share the suffering with his creatures. So a major consequence of God's decision to create a universe like the one we find ourselves in is that God must become incarnate in order to share in our suffering. Well, that's a moral obligation that God takes on. Why should we think that God has a moral obligation towards his creatures like that? Well, Francis McConnell, he thinks that the consequences of a morally perfect God's creative act are very clear. So here's a quote from McConnell. This is what he says. God is under heavy moral obligations to come near his children in the very deepest sense possible. He has sent his creatures forth into a terribly painful world, and he must do all he can to render the pain tolerable. He has bestowed upon men the unsolicited boon of freedom, an awful gift, and he is thereby under moral necessity to go to extremes to relieve men from the evil which thus becomes almost inevitable. If God is a moral God, we have in the infinite intensity of his ethical life a mighty pressure which sends him towards the lots of his children. We may speak of this as the center of power, as the conscience of God, to use a term which will suggest an unresting insistence. The father is under unescapable responsibility for the welfare of his children. So that's McConnell. So for McConnell, when God decides to create a universe like the one we find ourselves in, God acquires a moral obligation towards his creation. When God decides to create, God takes on a duty of care and responsibility for this universe. And part of that duty of care is the responsibility to see this creative project through to completion. As McConnell sees things, the incarnation of God is the outcome of God trying to satisfy this obligation. So McConnell says that God is, quote, really anxious to show us that our shoulders are not weighted with any burden which he is not willing so far as possible to take upon himself. I mean, think about that for a minute. God's not willing to let us undergo any kind of burden that he himself would not undergo. That sounds like a God who cares. That sounds like a God who is willing to take responsibility for his creative actions. By becoming incarnate, God freely takes on the responsibility of his creative project. He demonstrates that he is willing to share in the situation that he has placed us in. By becoming incarnate, God comes to know the loneliness of physical helplessness and the pathway to death. For McConnell, he says, quote, "The cross shows us a father under moral obligation to exert every moral influence for the moral salvation of his children." Yet, McConnell, he doesn't think that salvation of mankind, he doesn't think it's the primary function of the incarnation and Christ's death on a cross. So here's a longer quote from McConnell. This is what he says. He says, "The cross is, first of all, God's supreme satisfaction of his own conscience, the preservation of his own self-respect. God has sent men forth into a terrible universe without consulting them, and has thrust into their hands an awful boon of freedom. He is thus under enormous moral obligation. He need not have created men, but having created them, he cannot discharge his moral bonds to them and to himself short of Calvary. There is no responsibility in the universe so heavy as that of creatorship. If the biblical teaching that the earthly pain of man is in part at least a consequence of the moral evil, as within it, if that has within it a grain of truth, it is hard to see how a moral creator could have peace of conscience without sharing the pain made necessary by the moral imperfections flowing from an unsolicited gift of freedom." So that's the quote from McConnell. Personally, I find the suggestion quite plausible, and I find it very intriguing too. Something is morally suspect about a God who creates a universe with a kind of suffering that he himself is unwilling to endure. As I understand things, every view of providence affirms that sin, evil, and suffering are inevitable in the kind of universe that God selects to create. If God creates a universe knowing that suffering is inevitable, and God is unwilling to suffer along with his creatures, then God seems to be asking something utterly outrageous of his creatures. God would be commanding us to participate in his creative project without putting any skin in the game. And that just seems wrong to me. It would suggest that the lives of his creatures have no personal impact on him. Instead, a morally good God will not ask his creatures to endure a kind of suffering that he himself is unwilling to endure. A morally good God will demonstrate to his creatures that his creative project is worth it by becoming incarnate and enduring the kinds of trials that he asks us to endure. As I see it, the incarnation is in part a demonstration that God is willing to put some skin in the game in order to see his creative project through to the end. So as we come to celebrate Easter this weekend, I ask you to reflect on who God is and what God has done. Some accounts of the incarnation, they make the incarnation sort of an afterthought. The incarnation is merely the consequence of human sin and God needing to just kind of clean up our mess. I don't see things that way. I see the incarnation as deeper in God's plan for the universe. And as Christians, we worship a God who has a wise plan for creation, and that wise plan includes an incarnation in order to satisfy his duty of care towards creatures, God's willingness to enter into solidarity with our suffering, and the great lengths that God will go in order to enter into friendship with us. So let me be clear about something in closing. The suffering of this world, it is temporary. God and creatures are only experiencing suffering for a limited time as we engage in the work of creation. Once God's work of creation is complete, the eschatological wedding feast can fully be enjoyed by God and creatures. As McConnell explains, God and creatures share in the cross-bearing suffering that brings about a deep unity of love between God and humanity. This cross-bearing suffering will eventually give way to a joy and peace that shall never end. McConnell says that, "The pain is not the lasting phase of feeling, but joy. Joy abideth, peace remaineth. The joy and peace that endures take their start from fellowship in sorrow." And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on philosophical theology.